Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Michael Gomez. He is an historian. He's in the Department of History and the Department of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies at New York University. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. He'll be giving a talk in the MillerCom series. This is sponsored by a number of units on the campus, and particularly the African American Studies and Research and the Center for African Studies. This is the W.E.B. Du Bois lecture. He'll be giving a talk on the subject Global Africa, Whence Its Past, Whither Its Future, this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. These talks are always free and open to the public. Anyone who is interested should feel welcome to stop by and hear what Professor Gomez has to say. Here this morning on the program as we talk, questions are welcome too. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, and we do also have the toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here you have questions, you'd like to join in the conversation, you're certainly welcome to do that. Well, welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you for having invited me.
Something I'd like to try out to talk about a little bit here at the beginning, and I suppose this really is a question that has to do with the African diaspora.
Okay.
Africa is a place with clearly defined borders in one sense. When you say Africa, well, people can open up the atlas and they can show you where it is. But the fact is that over a long period of time, Africans have gone, generally they've been taken from Africa to the Americas, to the American South, to the Caribbean. From there, people spread out into Latin America and South America. So there are people of African descent living widely outside of Africa. And one of the things that I know that you've written about is the way in which those people made something new of themselves, created new cultures, new identities perhaps, as a result of being ripped out of their place and put down someplace else. So how do you incorporate the idea of the African diaspora in the idea of Africa and get people to think about it in a larger sense, more than just that specific place that's on the map?
Sure. Well, that's an excellent question. It's a rather broad question, but I'll do what I can with it. The project, most famously known as the African diaspora, usually encompasses the dispersal of people of African descent or Africans into the Americas, but it also encompasses as well Africans who move into the Mediterranean world, the Indian Ocean. Often all of these populations were transported into these areas involuntarily. And so the project of the African diaspora calls for an examination of these histories and experiences to look at convergences and divergences. It is simply a tool of analysis. It does not necessarily carry with it, political connotations or any particular ideology. And to that extent, it does comport with other kinds of analyses which are similar. So you have, Indian diasporic studies, Jewish diasporic studies, and so mm-hmm. forth. And so you have these parallel kinds of approaches to trying to understand what happens to people. And there is no monolithic approach to this. That is to say, scholars are quite divided in their approach. There are those who are Africanists, if you will. They are focused on the continent. They often do not take much interest in or see any connection to the history of that continent and those who were, dispersed abroad. Conversely, there are those who are focused on people of African descent in various locales, various sites, who do not necessarily see any connection to the continent of Africa. So with that said, my particular interest and focus is on examining the ties between the African continent, people of African descent throughout history. And I say that acknowledging that, you know, there are those who take different approaches and, you know, evaluate things differently.
Well, acknowledging the fact, given the fact that different scholars will look at this differently, I suppose, and something that the people that we're talking about have wrestled with and scholars have wrestled with does indeed have to do with identity. Mm-hmm. And perhaps one central question is, to what extent are these, do these people remain African? Mm-hmm. And to what extent are they something different? Not that that connection could ever completely be broken.
Right.
But then the question would be, well, in their identity, as they think of it, how much of that remains African? And we could be talking about, you know, generations after the fact that their forebears had left Africa. In what sense, after all of that, after forging some kind of new identity from different sort of influences, to what extent do they remain African?
Sure, that's an excellent question. And it goes right to the tension in much of the scholarship today. That is, those who are looking at African descendant populations in the Americas tend to be divided over this question. There are those who place premium on, you know, novelty and developments which take place post slavery or post the Atlantic slave trade period. And so their focus is on what is new, what is unique, what has taken place in the Americas, and they don't necessarily see very much African involvement, African influence, and so forth. Then there are those who invert the cone, and they tend to really heavily emphasize African cultures, continuities, retention, so forth and so on. Some of that language is dated. You know, the notion of cultural retentions and continuities and so forth is something that goes back to the days of Melville Herskovitz and so forth. And hopefully the scholarship, which does acknowledge African influence, has progressed beyond that point. My own scholarship tends to look at and identify African influences in the Americas, but I also recognize that those influences undergo transformation as a consequence of being, you know, in contact with other cultures and other people, and you know, kind of evolving over a long period of time. So I'm saying that, you know, the tension, while recognizable and understandable, often presents us with a false choice. That is to say, it's not a situation of it being, you know, a matter of people being fully African or fully, you know, New World. But one can recognize and acknowledge that there are these influences which stretch back to the old world, which have undergone transformation in the new. With that said, in many parts of the Americas, you can see clear ongoing kinds of traditions which stretch back, harken back, you know, to Africa. And they have undergone changes, without doubt. But and you see this most characteristically in the realm of religion. Mm-hmm. And so you have, for example, the Candomblé in Brazil, or Abaqua, or Santeria in Cuba and other parts of Spanish-speaking America, or Vodun in Haiti. Well, these are unquestionably related to practices which develop initially in the African continent but undergo transformation in the New World under various kinds of stresses and under different circumstances and conditions.
Yeah. Do you think that in the effort to understand Africa today, and we have to acknowledge the fact that obviously we're talking about a very big place with people that really are substantially different as you go from one place to another. So we wouldn't want to minimize that. But do you think that somehow in trying to understand Africa today, that it is important to recognize that there is this diaspora and that there are people of African descent who still have important connections and feel important connections? And I suppose my question is, Willie, in what sense, as far as Africa is concerned, in the way that we think about it, does that matter or does it matter?
Yes, it matters very much. And I would say in approaching this, I'm reminded of the classic kind of anthropological divide between lumpers and splitters. And you have the same kind of situation as it applies to Africa and its diaspora. First of all, let's recognize that there have been multiple diasporas. The one that we think about classically came about by way of the transatlantic slave trade. But subsequently, since World War II, there has been a significant immigration from Africa into the United States, into Europe, and other parts of the world. And so you have, this older classic, if you will, diaspora, which has been augmented by a more recent diaspora, if you will, or migration. The question then becoming, what is the relationship between those diasporas, and do they necessarily see each other as being similar? Do they see any relationship between them? This is an ongoing kind of question. But certainly, you have the more recent African diaspora. It is very, very significant to the African continent, given, the phenomenon of remittances. Many African economies are buoyed by the remittances which are coming back to the continent from persons who are in the UK, in France, in Italy, in the US, in Canada. And so there is an economic tie here that's very, very important. So you do have what we can call an African diaspora, but then, as I've alluded to earlier, there is a temporal dimension, between this earlier diaspora and the subsequent diaspora. But then also we can go deeper into the diasporas. And so you have, significant immigration from Nigeria, significant immigration from Senegal, just to name two states. So we can talk about an African diaspora, we can talk about a Nigerian diaspora, Senegalese diaspora, and then we can go even further into that and talk about specific ethnicities, ethnic groups coming through that process. And so going back to the whole lump or splitter dichotomy, we can make this as convenient or as complex, as we choose. Mm-hmm.
So I think you pointed at a way in which the immigrant experience of today and of recent years perhaps is different than it was. I guess one can overstate that, but I guess I'm thinking about the fact that there was a period where people left, in whatever circumstances, people left the place that they were born, and the connection was broken, and the idea that they would somehow go back would just be not possible. And then we get over a period of time, we get to the point where the idea of going back becomes more possible, becomes easier, and the people don't really think about making some kind of a clean break between the old and the new. And we increasingly, I think, come into a time where people are maybe a little bit more likely to maintain a kind of dual sense of identity. That is, it's not just that was then and I was that person and this is now and I'm a different person. It's not quite like that anymore. And I think it's interesting to think about now what that means and what that will continue to mean for the place of origin and the relationship of the person to that place. And what do, and how often do they go back? And do they think that they might someday go back and live in the place of origin again? And do they send money back? And how important do family connections remain? And what are the implications of this idea of dual citizenship, which is much more common and much more possible now than it has been in the past?
Yeah, I think that those are excellent observations. What I would say is what's remarkable about we might call the historical diasporic formation. What's really remarkable about that is, yes, in many instances, in most instances, people who may have been interested in a return to Africa were not able to effect that for obvious reasons. But what's really fascinating about it is that in the folklore, in the religion, in the literature that develops, there is this ongoing consciousness of Africa, you know, as place of origin. And there is this ongoing conversation about and questions about what is the relationship between those who find themselves in America and the continent of Africa. So I would say that although people would not necessarily be able to make the physical reconnection to Africa, it was certainly something that inhabited their dreams and their aspirations in many instances. And in some cases, there was an attempt to recreate conditions in the Americas, for example, in maroon societies and so forth. What's going to be interesting and fascinating is to see how the children and grandchildren of more recent African immigrants navigate this very complicated question of identity. This is going to be very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. I think to the extent that they are able to speak the language of their parents and grandparents and to carry, you know, the name of their parents and grandparents, that they will probably be able to do very well, okay, in terms of both being an American in whatever context that is, and being of African origin. It is the case, however, that there are many second, third generation scions of immigrants who have a much more difficult time because they are not able to speak the language of their parents or grandparents. And this is true of not only immigrants from Africa, but immigrants from the Caribbean, Latin America, and so forth. That is to say, once the cultural ties begin to unravel or begin to weaken, you know, the experience can be rather difficult for them.
Yeah. Well, that's something that I'm sure that we have seen with other immigrant groups as well. The first generation comes and they're still, in many ways, very rooted in the home country. And then they have children and they're the ones that are sort of have one foot on each side. And by the time you get to the third generation, then you find people, whatever it was, if they came here speaking another language, you get to the third generation, they are exclusive English speakers. They may not speak that language of their grandparents at all.
Right.
And that they're really thinking of themselves as Americans.
Yes.
And their connections with the culture and the place they came from can be pretty sketchy.
Yes.
And so that just seems to be something that happens and has happened a lot. And it doesn't matter where you're talking about the people coming from. You see that pattern repeated over and over.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there is a kind of universality to that experience. I think much revolves on the question of the relationship of the immigrant and their progeny to the polity. And if, in fact, there are mechanisms by which these individuals can realize the potential of citizenship situation in a given country, then that would greatly facilitate their becoming American or Canadian or, you know, whatever the particular context. I mean, so we have a fantastic example of that. We have an individual who is running for the presidency, and he is at least partially the child of an immigrant. He bears a surname which links him to a geographic location in Africa. Now imagine if you know, he didn't have that. Imagine if his last name had been changed and it was Williams or Smith. It would have weakened even further that connection, you know, to his father's place of origin. It'll be interesting to see how his children identify themselves and how they negotiate this matter.
Let me take just a moment here to introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580. He is visiting here at the campus. His name is Michael Gomez. He's an historian. He is in the Department of History and also the Department of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies at New York University. He's here to give a talk. This is in the MillerCom series, talking about global Africa, its past and its future. It's this afternoon at 4 at the Levis Faculty Center, and anybody who is interested should stop by. These talks are always free and open to the public. Questions here are welcome to 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. I know that one of the things that you're interested in your work is the movement that we saw in the 19th century, the back to Africa, the return movement, that there were a substantial number of people who were talking about going back and reestablishing, perhaps creating something new. Would you ever expect to see something like that again? I mean, do we actually in some ways have a foundation laid for at some time in the relatively near future something like that ever again?
I think that's always possible. I think that, although I don't think it likely, I think it possible. And that tends to be related to, you know, the social and political and economic experiences of people during the period in question. And so if populations feel assaulted and feel that they are very much under the heel and that their prospects in the U.S. Are dim and growing dimmer with each passing minute, you may very well see that kind of response. But I don't think my sense of it is that African Americans are becoming more and more invested in the United States, that this is their home, that they would like to make connections to the African continent with respect to, you know, legacy and heritage and that type of thing. But that generations of people of African descent have made so many contributions to the country and have sacrificed so much that I would say the vast majority see the country, you know, as their home and are committed to making, you know, the best of it. The other aspect to it is that in the 19th century and into the turn of the 20th century, many of the back to Africa movements were fueled by either religious concepts and beliefs, or a highly politicized atmosphere that was charged by developments in the international arena. Probably the most significant so-called back to Africa movement was the Garvey movement. What's interesting about the Garvey movement, of course, is that Marcus Garvey himself never went to Africa. It's not clear that he really envisioned, you know, black people from every corner, you know, pulling up stakes and moving back to Africa, but rather he was calling for a kind of relationship with Africa that could improve its status and condition. And of course, this was during a period of time in which Africa was under colonial rule. And this was also a period in time in which you had the rise of a significant empire in Europe. And so the Garvey movement could be understood as a response to that. And, you know, It was an expression of an aspiration to create another kind of empire. You also have, for example, the Rastafarian movement, which identifies Ethiopia as homeland. Mm. And that is a very important development. It is essentially religiously inspired. For many Rastafari, that still remains, you know, a goal, a return. And you do have other kinds of communities which espouse these kinds of aspirations. But I think by and large, any kind of wholesale large scale Back to Africa movement probably will not develop unless there's some sort of catastrophic occurrence that really, really throws into serious question the future of people of African descent in this country.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with some people who are listening. We have a couple here. We'll start with someone who is in Urbana on our line number one, right here. Hello.
Oh, yeah. Hi. How are you? David's right. This is a very complex situation, also a very complex continent, because you have the northern part, which is a lot Arabic or Arabs, and then you have the sub-Saharan, the Saharan, and then you have all the what you call the Black Africa or whatever. But I was going to ask you a question about modern immigration, like within the last 5 to 6 years, in relationship to what I think is an abject failure of post-colonial experiences. Zimbabwe, you call the Mugabe experience, who basically, I don't know what his problem is, but he just seems like an autocrat determined to hang on until he drops dead. And then you have Somalia, which is mostly Arabic and religious, and then you have Darfur, you have Nigeria, their problems with their autocracies and their complete failure of allowing of democracy in these areas, or democratic rule, or rule of the people, or whatever. So you have people you know, basically escaping, more, I think the word immigration is a bit light. They're escaping this, you call the heel in the West. How about the heel in Africa, where you have people, I mean, look at Congo, look at Rwanda, look at all this tribalism, look what just happened in Kenya. It seems like it's an endless murder and endless slaughter by their own, quote, people. Versus the, you know, let's say the colonialists weren't exactly friendly to these people either, treated them like they were nothing. And then post-colonial experience in the last 5 to 10 years has been, it's unbelievable, probably the only modest success is South Africa itself. I mean, I'm not quite sure, I've never been there, but it seems to me like it's such a disaster, and it doesn't seem to get better. And I think it's nice to sit here in the United States and in the West and talk about all these, intellectualize it. But I think that when you go to these people, they're so upset. They're so misused by their own people, murdered. I mean, 5 million people have been murdered, not counting Rwanda, in East Congo. I mean, it's endless. And no, I mean, Darfur's just, it just so upsets me so much that nothing seems to be done about this. Thank you.
Well, how do you think about that?
Well, certainly, I resonate with the concern of the caller. He made points both forcefully and emphatically. I think that there's no doubt that there are challenges facing the African continent, which must be addressed. And it's true that it's a very complex equation that we're trying to solve. I think it's easy to retreat to an explanation which involves the colonial experience and say that, well, you know, the continent is in this situation because of colonialism, because of these artificial borders, because of the placement and power of individuals who are trained by the colonial state, who have aspirations to essentially mimic what has gone on before, as opposed to having any true interest in their constituencies. We can talk about how these economies, which quite frankly represent the core of the issue, how these economies were set up and created in the interests of Western powers, and how to this day so many African states are having difficulties breaking out of this pattern of the export of raw materials in exchange for importing finished products from elsewhere. So it's a difficult tangle. There's no doubt about that. And to the extent that African leadership is to be faulted for current circumstances, I have no issue with that. I think, however, what we want to avoid is a kind of hypocrisy which says that, you know, the African continent is a mess, you know, it's not our problem, our being the West, or at this point, including Asia, it's not our problem. It is, in fact, the legacy of Western Western policies in Africa, and the continuation of policies which undermine African productivity in the international market. So I think that you know, it's going to take a collective effort to bring about the kinds of changes that we also desperately want to see. But what I don't want to leave the your listeners with is the belief that you know, Africans created this dilemma all by themselves. They are continuing with these difficulties largely as a consequence of their own doing, and that it's up to them alone to emerge from these difficulties.
Certainly there are many countries that that face serious problems. Two, one would be very, very serious inequality when it comes to the way that resources are allocated, and another would be very serious problems with underdeveloped infrastructure, roads and power systems and water and schools and all of those things that you really need to have if you're going to have a flourishing economy. And it seems, though, that in the way that people think about this, and maybe it does have to do, in fact, with the kind of news that we see coming out of Africa, it seems that a major problem that underlies all of this has something to do with the inability to transcend tribalism and to develop in people a sense of nationalism. That is, that somehow that were, however those whoever drew those lines and those borders, that in some sense we're all one people, and that the welfare of one is connected to the welfare of all. Is that, are we making a mistake if we put too much emphasis on that kind of view and that kind of analysis that says, well, what really the problem really is here is it's the triumph of tribalism over nationalism?
Well, I think that this goes to the point that the representation of Africa in the West is often caricatured and oversimplified and misrepresented. And I think it's easy for the media and for you know, so-called intellectuals to represent the complexity of Africa by simply referring to tribalism, and that everything is a function of these problems and these divisions. I think that there are other factors that we don't have time to get into here, which very much play into this matter. But if we take, for example, you know, a country like Sudan, it's very clear that you have a state called Sudan. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you have communities, you have populations within that state, which historically did not function as a single polity, did not necessarily have a common set of interests or a common set of purposes. As a matter of fact, historically may have been at war or at least in some state of tension with one another. So it becomes difficult and really probably unrealistic to see to expect people to all of a sudden or over a period of time begin to see themselves in some sort of national unit. I think that's very difficult. And in particular, it's very difficult when the revenues and the resources of the state are not equitably distributed. I think it's possible for a multi-ethnic state to proceed and to improve on the condition that its resources are equitably distributed. But in state after state, we see this is not taking place. And so it really, really drives the grievances within these states, and it makes it very difficult.
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest is Michael Gomez from New York University, professor of history and Middle Eastern and Islamic studies. He's here to talk about Africa, its past, its future. It's a talk this afternoon at 4 on the U of I campus in the Millicom series, so anyone interested can stop by and hear him. Also, questions here are welcome. We have a couple of people who are ready to go, and we'll talk next with someone in Champaign County on line one. Hello.
Hi. This innocent bystander attitude that people have about Africa is just infuriating. You handled that quite well, I thought. But it isn't just the legacy of you know, colonialism. It's the legacy of structural adjustment, which is never treated in the conditions in Kenya. I mean, when you have people told that they have to pay a fee to go to school, and one ethnic group is more economically deprived in that area, and consequently you get this kind of division. This is the kind of thing that amplifies the tribalism, and it's the economic part that is very, very little treated. A global image of that is this image that we have that there's so much development aid going into Africa when, you know, the AIDS budget was actually a flatline budget. It was increased some, but it's got so many conditions on it, like 40% has to go to abstinence and they have to buy products that are unnaturally high because of Big Pharma's influence in the whole deal. You have all those things going on. And then you have this overall thing that I don't think has been rectified, which is that even with the debt revocation, and I don't call it forgiveness because a lot of that was odious debt to begin with, which is a legal term, curiously enough, so much of that, despite all that, that much that has been revoked, there's still been a net capital extraction from Africa, even through those broad finance terms. And then when, as you mentioned, you referred to the price of commodities, I mean, when you have fire sale prices for coal tin out of Zaire, and if there was actually some real commitment to resolving the situation, the price would go up. How much interest is there really in the capitals of the West and the North that to actually solve anything there when the status quo from their economic balance sheets is quite okay? Now, I actually, since you are talking also about diaspora issues, I wanted to mention a couple of things that I've just learned that I'd never known about the experience in the U.S. That in the beginning in Virginia, in the slavery days, chattel slavery wasn't quite the rule at first. There were actually people who were treated more like, you know, indentured servants who came from Europe, that they would come over and they would work for a period of time. That's why we have so many freedmen, I guess, in the diaspora here. They actually were not involved in, you know, some of them then were captured back into slavery when chattel slavery became the rule. And it's a real hideous story that I had never heard about before. And I just, you know, another thing that just incidentally, and maybe this is too much of a digression, is that the series that Louis Gates is doing on the preoccupation with African identity and the genetic studies and all that, I think is a psychic back to Africa movement, if you will, and it has revealed things to me that I'd never known before, which is that I think as Don Cheadle was actually, his ancestry was owned by Indians. They were Native Americans who were only displaced themselves. They had their own diaspora, and that's why he's from Oklahoma, because his family was owned by an Indian, a Native American tribe. So I'd never known those two things before. It seems like those are basic things that we should know about in American history, but we just can't confront. I realize I've gone on for quite a while, so I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right, you can pick any of that that you want.
That was quite a wide range of discourse there. What I would say is the caller is quite right. Africa reels from the cumulative effect of a series of developments going back not just simply to colonialism, but to post-colonial developments having to do with experimentation with Marxist and neo-Marxist kinds of regimes, having to do with taking out bad loans, including from the Soviet Union, having to do, you know, with moving to a phase of IMF and World Bank strictures and demands, which have been disastrous in the view of many. Structural adjustment programs follow thereafter, which have also been disastrous. So the continent is reeling from a whole series of policies undertaken by international players, which have not been in the interest of the continent. I would say that as well, the caller is probably on to something when he says that there's a kind of psychic return, I think, to Africa. I think that there is certainly, and it goes back to the remark I made earlier, that is to say that even though people were not able or to physically make a return, there has been this abiding interest in their relationship to the continent. It goes back a long, long time. And the instrumentality of science is making things very, very interesting. I'd just like to say that what it does point to, however, is the possibilities of the science suggest that in fact, the notion of the African descendant is very, very widespread. And those who are phenotypically European-looking may very well also be of African descent, probably the most famous case of this being Mr. Watson, who made some very unfortunate remarks about black people some months ago, only to find out this is the James
the,
Watson.
The DNA.
The double helix guy. Who, in fact, subsequently found out that a significant portion of his own DNA composition was of African origin. So there are probably many, many listeners out there who would be further surprised by their own relationship to Africa, should they have opportunity and interest to pursue it.
One more caller, at least, in the time remains. This is Champagne in line two. Hello.
Yes, hi. I'm currently reading a book by Martin Meredith called The Fate of Africa, and I was wondering if you were familiar with this book and if you think this book is useful for people that want to learn more about the history of Africa and understand more about both the historical background and the current situation there. And I'll hang up. Thank you.
I've heard of the book. I have not read it. I'm not in a position to recommend or not.
Well, let me ask you this then. I suppose, do you think that the governments of the West, say just the United States, mm-hmm. I mean, is there something that you think the government of the United States would be in a position to do that would be positive and constructive for Africa?
Yeah, sure. I think that what we have to do is to take a look at the first thing we have to do is to take a look at the trade relations between Africa and the West, which and that's a difficult call because the relations are such that they really are not in the interest of African agricultural producers. If you change the relation such that, you know, you don't impose tariffs on African agricultural imports, then it tends to have or possibly could have an effect on American farmers. So there is a problem there that needs to be worked through. But I think that, you know, we definitely have to allow African countries to become international players to the extent that they at least are able to participate in the international market on an equal basis. And obviously we want to see the encouragement of, you know, manufacturing capacities in Africa. It's a very curious thing to me because you see the flight of capital to, you know, Latin America, to Asia, precisely because, you know, they can pay people less. That's not something to be lauded. To be sure, but what's interesting is that you haven't had a similar kind of movement to Africa, which arguably could have been beneficial. And so I would like to see not necessarily the flight of American jobs to Africa, but I would like to see greater emphasis placed upon productive capacities beyond agriculture. So as we're looking at it now, it's listen, this is a continuation of you know, kind of pre-colonial kinds of relationships where Africa is seen as or is expected to continue to export, you know, primary products and never is in a situation in which they can begin to produce finished products for export. And so it has moved from, you know, people in the case of the slave trade to, you know, ground nuts to oil to now petroleum. And so a number of countries, Nigeria, Cameroon, Mozambique, and so forth, have or will have tremendous capacity to produce and export oil. My thinking, however, is that this will probably not be the panacea that these countries are looking for.
All right. Very quickly, I'm trying to get one more caller here in Urbana. I'll have to ask you to be brief, though, but please go ahead.
Line two?
Yes.
Yeah, this is a comment that could serve as a question, perhaps. I think no matter what our governments do for African countries, the credibility of our actions will depend on what we can do for the African-American community here. Until that community becomes truly equal and part of the society, our actions are not going to be taken with any kind of credibility. Plus, I think once the community here is on par, there is more of a chance that the contacts it will develop with Africa will be more fruitful. I'll just hang and listen.
Opening up a subject that we could spend a lot more time talking about, that is, you know, the ways in which the fate of African Americans are linked to the fate of Africa.
The caller makes an excellent point. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, if we just reflect upon the way in which the population of New Orleans was treated in the aftermath of Katrina, it reveals a lot. It not only reveals the disparities, ongoing disparities in the country, but it also reflects the perspective of the federal government and other entities which are empowered, the perspective toward the poor and the helpless, those who are in need. So if we treat our own citizenship, if we treat our own citizens in this way, okay, then it's unlikely that we are prepared to extend significant help to those who look like them and are outside of the borders.
We will have to stop there because we've come to the end of the time. But I do, again, want to mention that our guest, Michael Gomez, will be talking as part of the Millercom series. The talk is, the title for the talk is Global Africa, Whence Its Past, Whither Its Future. And he'll be talking this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. It's an event. It's open to anyone who would like to attend, so feel welcome to stop by. Michael Gomez, Professor of History and Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies at New York University. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.